Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
We try to celebrate the independence of the Fed, but unfortunately the Fed is mostly a captured institution. It's captured by big Wall Street banks, because also sitting on that open market committee are the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks. And those presidents are not selected by a president of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. Those regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents are chosen by private boards of directors.
Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, Ellen speaks with our guest, Professor Tim Canova, whom you just heard, an expert on the Federal Reserve and an advisor on Capitol Hill, who worked with Bernie Sanders' Senate initiative in 2011 to begin a new level of scrutiny over the Fed's operations, including calling for the first audit of part of the organization. As the Fed continues to go its own way with interest rates that seem to set us up for accelerated market risks and more costly credit, a continuing debate questions whether the Federal Reserve is a public institution or a private fiefdom owned by the banks. This debate has become a focus this year as momentum for the Green New Deal legislation emerging on Capitol Hill moves into the spotlight in Washington and elsewhere, including France and all of Europe. One could fairly ask, where are the central banks when we need them? The needed financing for sustainable economies, communities, and nations seems to depend completely on the select few banking interests that use our productivity and public assets as pawns in their quest for increasing profits regardless of the public interest. Such things as the $1.5 trillion student debt load, our failing infrastructure investments, our affordable housing crisis, profound environmental challenges. Surely if the Federal Reserve belonged to the people and was an active player in our well-being, wouldn't it help provide the needed funds for Main Street's survival and improvement? Well, as you'll hear from Professor Canova, that's not what the Federal Reserve actually does, though it could. On the contrary, the Fed can easily, and has in the past, created trillions of dollars for its big bank owners and allies all over the world, while stepping aside from the domestic responsibilities that it should engage to help common citizens and communities. Tim Canova will reveal other troubling examples of how our central government and systems work for the moneyed interests and established political powers in spite of the systems established to protect the public and to respect our democracy. So stay tuned for that conversation. There are several news items of interest about our money this week, one involving the appointment of freshman U.S. Congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to the House Financial Services Committee, where she'll participate in monitoring and examining the banking and finance sectors of the U.S. economy, a catbird seat, if you will, to observe the deals and dealings of our money institutions. Of clear interest to us is the fact that AOC, as she's called in shorthand, is a supporter of public banking, and has called for public banks at the state, local, and national levels in her outline of what the Green New Deal should become. This is an exciting moment in that the 100th anniversary of America's only public bank, the highly successful Bank of North Dakota, is having a centenary celebration that will help bring a focus to the prospect of creating public banks in America. And while we're focused on Washington, let's point out that the Trump administration this week is calling on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to abandon the provisions it employed under the previous Obama administration that would protect consumers from payday lenders. As observed by economist Bill Black, one of the CFPB's most important and useful anti-predatory lending rules by payday lenders is what we're talking about. Payday lenders, as you may know, often charge working-class Americans interest rates well above 100%. In fact, in Missouri, which is a hotbed of predation, they can charge more than 500%. The provision in question addresses that sweet spot for payday lenders, where borrowers can be identified as unable to repay promptly the initial loan, but have enough income to pay off the entire series of loans, which results in extraordinary and obscene interest rate accrual. And so it goes with power. Those who have it can abuse it, or use it for transformational purposes. 2019 is likely to show us examples of both. Now, let's talk with Ellen.
All right, Ellen, here we are into the early start of 2019 with a broad landscape of developments occurring from Capitol Hill all the way to France and into our local communities where people are getting more animated about the systems that are working and not working to support our economy. We've got a government shutdown at the moment. We've got growing consumer debt. We've got a looming prospect of another financial crisis. There are some very serious things lining up, and it's also the 100th anniversary of the Bank of North Dakota. So there's some bright spots and there's some gloomy spots. How are you seeing things now?
Well, we've got the government shutdown, as you point out, and we've seen pictures of legislators partying on the beach in Puerto Rico. And meanwhile, you've got the workers who something like 40% of the population can't come up with $400 in an emergency without borrowing or selling something. So you've got the workers who are living paycheck to paycheck, not all of them, of course, but the ones who are having trouble paying their rent. So the people at the top don't really care. They can afford the time. They can call it a vacation because they'll get the money later. And there's just it seems to be an inability to perceive the problems at the other end. And right. In France, you've got the same thing where what the Yellow Vests are protesting originally, anyway, was the gas tax, which was supposedly a green measure to force people, apparently, to not drive gas-burning cars. Well, what are they going to do? If they're living paycheck to paycheck, they can't rush out and buy an electric car. They have to drive their cars, they have to get to work, and they just have to pay more for their gas. So it's a let-them-eat-cake situation, a saying that came out of France with Marie Antoinette. So we've got that dichotomy between the rich and the poor, and the rich, or, well, I saw somebody said in France that the government was worried about saving the planet, and they're worried about feeding their families this week or whatever. Mm-hmm. The government doesn't seem to be worried about the people and the plight of the people. But as we know, there's another way to fund all these things. First of all, a government shutdown should be illegal, or it's unconstitutional. The 14th Amendment says that the government will pay its bills as and when due, or something to that effect. So they have incurred the debt. They've passed the budget. They've hired these people. The people, there's a contractual obligation to pay them. The government must pay them. And then the question is, well, where do you find the money? The government does not need to borrow on the private market to do that. They could just borrow from their own Federal Reserve, which can create the money on its books. I mean, they can't do it the way the law is structured right now, but they should change the law to allow them to generate the money we need. And in fact, the whole reason they don't do that is supposedly it would be inflationary, but we just don't have inflation. We've been struggling for, they can't even get up to the 2% that they've been aiming for, or they rarely hit it anyway. So we are clearly not at full employment. Even if we were at full employment, it wouldn't mean that we were at full productive capacity. As Tim Canova points out in our interview today, that in World War II, they were beyond full capacity. So what that means is you hire people for overtime, or it seems to me today you hire machines, or you send the work abroad or something. Anyway, there are all sorts of reasons why we are not really at full capacity, and we needn't worry about inflation. In fact, we need to put more money into the economy just to cover the gap between debt and the money available to pay the debts. First of all, because debt always grows faster than the real economy, since more money is always owed back than was put out there in the first place. The money is created as a debt. And second of all, because not everybody pays their money into the economy, so they're sitting on savings or whatever. So we need to have a new vision of how to fund the economy.
And also, it would seem, on how to balance the economy more fairly. It seems to me that we're seeing the collapse of the trend of the economy to feed all the profits to one end of the social spectrum and then to starve the rest, that the trends toward efficiency and production that are driven by technology and robotics and all of the new things that are eliminating the workforce, and then the lowering of the wages that are needed to support workers' lives, all of that coming to a fore, the discussion of a universal basic income as a way of trying to stave off the collapse of a basically a capitalist system that is now very long in the tooth. It seems to me that 2019 is presenting itself as a pretty challenging frontier for the people and the people's interests against the established institutions that have failed or that are failing them now and are likely to get even worse. So we have this stuff on Capitol Hill, this uprising, women, millennials, workers' interests facing off against systems like the Federal Reserve, which, as you said in with Professor Canova, could but doesn't step in. So there was a point in 2008 where the Federal Reserve could have done something different to bring money into existence but didn't. Why was that? Why didn't they step in? And what's it going to take for them to do something like that now, along the lines of what you just said?
The Federal Reserve will say that they didn't have the ability under existing law to do anything, but the Federal Reserve only works with the banks. They can't spend money directly into the economy, so they say. But in Switzerland, the Swiss National Bank is actually buying up stock. I wrote an article about how the Swiss National Bank had bought the FANG stocks, and that was driving the market up. So they were basically manipulating the market. So the FANG stocks are the big ones, you know, Facebook, Apple, what is it?
Netflix
and Google. So yeah, they're buying the big stocks, and then that sets the tone, and then everybody thinks the market's going up, so everybody jumps in on all the other stocks too. Well, they were actually selling the FANG stocks early in the fall before the market dropped. So they were manipulating the market downward as well. So the central bank has far too much power. It's acting not in the interests of the people, obviously. So this whole idea of an independent central bank, which does not consider itself part of the government, being able to call the shots on our economy is simply wrong. I mean, that needs to be changed, and it's up to Congress to change it, because Congress wrote the Federal Reserve Act. They can rewrite the Federal Reserve Act. But it seems to me, besides the fact that we know that big lobbyists are controlling everything, there is just a misperception about how money works, where it comes from, and that they could, in fact, be issuing a lot more money without hurting the economy and, in fact, helping the economy, that the economy needs that extra boost, needs that extra money. You've got to put the money out there first. You've got to have the demand first before producers will produce. Otherwise, you can give them interest-free loans, and they will use it to buy back their stock rather than to put it into buying new equipment or whatever it takes to do more productivity, because they don't have customers to buy their products.
Here we are faced off with the opportunity to create a Green New Deal along the lines of the success of FDR's thing in the 30s. And it's not just a national interest. It's an international movement. But when it comes right down to it, to solving problems, to having the Fed do work for us, or for us to be able to rely on our institutions, it seems to me that this is going to be a very big year for confronting the powers that be with what the people are going to demand. And I don't know what you think, but it seems to me like the Federal Reserve is going to be a really big target on this. One of the questions that comes up is, who does the Federal Reserve work for? Is it a public institution or is it a private institution? Tell us about that distinction.
Well, there are 7 members of the Federal Reserve Board who are appointed by the president and confirmed by the legislature. So you would assume that those people are working for the people, that they have a mandate to serve the public. Then there are 5 more people on the Federal Open Market Committee, which meets behind closed doors and calls the shots on raising the interest rates or lowering them or whatever, you know, what the Fed does. It's all in secret. And they are clearly private because the Federal Reserve branches are 100% owned by the banks in their districts. So the 5 that are from the Federal Reserve branches are all presidents. They rotate the presidents of those banks. But it's the New York Fed is always there, and then 4 others rotate. So the New York Fed clearly has the most clout, and that's where Wall Street is.
That's Wall Street.
Big Wall Street banks. At the very least, the 12 branches, it seems to me, we should buy the stock back, which we could easily do through the Federal Reserve. We don't have to use the taxpayers. Fed can buy back the stock and make that public and have people on those boards who represent, you know, all sectors of the economy, not just bankers. They are really acting in the interests of the banks. So, I mean, once they're appointed, then they're on their own, as we can see, because President Trump has been routinely criticizing the Fed for increasing the interest rates and for tightening the money supply at a time when it's not clear that the economy, I mean, it's definitely not overheated. It may be technically at full employment, but we know they're not really at full employment. So you've got the president, who is supposedly sitting there right at the top, criticizing him, but it doesn't seem to have any effect. In other words, he has no control, and obviously the Congress has no control either. They could modify the Federal Reserve Act, but they don't. And like you say, it's because we have a corrupt government, and that is the interesting thing about Timothy Canova's experience. As difficult as it was, he's going to start writing about it. When you have instances like that out there and you can point to them and say, this is a corrupt government, we just have to change this system, starting with changing the voting machines that are private. They shouldn't be private.
There are many instances of how the reality of our circumstance, of where the rules and the policies and the preferences are made behind curtains of power, behind curtains of deception, that keep people in line and just plodding along day to day. It seems to me, and of course maybe it's just my hopeful nature, that this is a possible year for a breakthrough. That by looking at the success of the Bank of North Dakota as one example, but also realizing that the power of public banking is now starting to be understood much more broadly, that this is a year where a change at the legislative levels might provide some new openings. I think people are really getting tired and are being worn out about their circumstances and are being pushed to the edge. That's my own view about where our money is in the United States at this time. Do you have any thoughts that this might be a breakthrough year, or are we just going to put up and shut up?
It could well be a crisis year, and they do say that crises are when change happens, so with luck. So if we get a groundswell of support, that's what we need, is public support, a big mass popular movement, hopefully not taking to the streets and burning down cars like in France, but a movement at the polls, and if we had fair polls.
As these things come about, what I think we hope to do on this program is give people context and understanding about some of the systems that are operating here. Your conversation with Tim Canova is very interesting coming up here, and we'll be taking a look also at how the Bank of North Dakota, this centenary observation, has dealt with problems in their past, how they got past it, and how they've built this powerhouse of public interest at a banking level. All of these things are coming forward for us in 2019. So this is going to be an interesting year. We'll stay tuned, huh? Let's see what happens next.
Okay, right.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thanks a lot. I'm very pleased to be speaking with Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida and an expert on the Federal Reserve and its history. Tim has written dozens of articles and portions of books, taught at a number of universities, served as legislative assistant in the Senate, and served on an advisory committee put together by Bernie Sanders on reforming the Fed. He also ran for Florida representative to the U.S. House of Representatives twice, challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And we were most pleased to have him speak at our Public Banking Institute conference in San Rafael, in San Rafael, California, in 2013. So, Tim, it's great to be talking to you again.
Well, thanks. My pleasure.
So you've had quite a journey in the last few years, starting with when you were on Senator Sanders' team to reform the Fed. I guess you came up with some great proposals, but unfortunately not much came of it. And then you ran against Debbie Wasserman Schultz and twice and were defeated with where there was like provable corruption in the election system. So being a lawyer, you took it to court and discovered there was also corruption in the legal system. So do you want to talk a bit about that?
Well, sure. I can start with the Bernie Sanders advisory panel that started in 2011 and I think went through some of 2012. And you're right, not much came of it. The task force, I should say the advisory committee, was tasked with a couple of different big issues. One was the governance structure of the Fed, and the second was the Fed's authority to deal with the economic crisis. And I think the only tangible thing that came out of it was one bill that Bernie Sanders introduced that would have tinkered with the governance structure of the Fed about how I think the Class B directors are chosen by the regional Federal Reserve banks. So there was not even more far-reaching reforms that came out of Senator Sanders from that committee. The committee itself, I thought, did some interesting work, and the committee was split, but part of the committee that I was with, of course, was pushing for more far-reaching reforms, and not just of the governance structure, but also to get the Fed to essentially do a quantitative easing program for Main Street the way it had for Wall Street. So that was back around 2011 and 12. When I decided to run against Wasserman Schultz, that was 4 years later, and it really sort of came out of the blue. I had gotten involved with a group that was lobbying against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Citizens Trade Campaign, and we were trying to get our local congresswoman to oppose the TPP, and that was Wasserman Schultz. And turned out she became the only Florida Democrat in the House delegation to vote to fast track the TPP. So at that point, we started looking for a candidate who would challenge her, and we tried to get other folks to challenge her. We were looking for people who were state legislators or local elected officials, but it was tough. Nobody wanted to challenge her because she was the head of the Democratic National Committee, and ultimately, I did, and of course, she wasn't just the head of the DNC. She was also trying to impede the campaign of Bernie Sanders through the primary season, and I think doing a good job of that. And the first campaign went very well. We raised a lot of money. As you mentioned, the results were unsatisfying, and we had our suspicions. So I tried to inspect the ballots and actually sued to inspect the ballots. And the response of Brenda Snipes, who was then the Broward Supervisor of Elections, was to simply just destroy all the ballots, which violated numerous state and local criminal statutes. And we couldn't get any law enforcement to investigate or prosecute. And I ran again as an independent in 2018, and I warned that if Brenda Snipes was not prosecuted, if there was no consequences for destroying ballots, they would rig the election again. And we believe they did. The statistical evidence is not believable whatsoever. We have leading experts in computational science who have analyzed the data, and they've seen that I was capped at the same low percentage for every single demographic group, which the experts say is statistically impossible. It's beyond improbable. They said it would be like winning the lottery every day for a year. So we've filed a complaint in the Florida Circuit Court, and we've filed a complaint with the House of Representatives. There's lots of troubling evidence from this past election that these elections are just so easily rigged. It's amazing. The scanning machine in Florida, when you fill out a paper ballot, you hand the ballot to an election official who then turns and puts the ballot through a scanning machine. And those scanning machines have, I kid you not, they have wireless cellular modems on them. So it's an open invitation for an outside hacker. And we believe that it's very possible, and we've got lots of experts who think this is what's happening, is that there's hackers that are essentially just changing a few lines of source code in the software and engineering whatever election results they want.
It seems unbelievable to me. I mean, it's believable, but it's so clearly not right that they would have private voting machines. I mean, that it's something that somebody can't get in there and double-check on. But like you say, I mean, who do you sue? You tried suing, and it didn't work. You've got various houses of government that are supposed to check each other, and it's not working. So that's a pretty sobering statement on the state of our country,
yeah,
I think.
It is. And I'll tell you, the software, if you want to inspect the software, whether you're a candidate who has lost, whether you're a private citizen, if you've brought a lawsuit, any of those scenarios, you cannot inspect the software. It's considered proprietary, the private property of the private the private software vendors that the local election officials hire.
Yeah,
so there's no transparency whatsoever. There's no way to verify the actual vote count. And they count on most people not even trying to verify the vote. When's the last time you've really heard of very many folks who lose a race, especially if they've lost by more than a few percentage points, that actually ask to see the ballot? It hardly ever happens.
Yeah, I don't know what can be done about that. Then there was the race in New York of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where it was a dramatic upset. So things do happen, but I guess they weren't anticipating that. Or maybe some candidates are corrupt enough to tinker with the voting machines and others, or, you know, manage to get in there and have the influence to tinker with them, and others don't. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'll say this, that if they can rig the machines here in Broward County, they can rig them in an awful lot of jurisdictions in this country. It doesn't mean they are rigging them everywhere, but it means if there happens to be some crucial election, usually the technology is there where the results, I think, can be manipulated. Mm-hmm. Now, let's assume it was not done in Ocasio-Cortez's race. It could be for a lot of local reasons, including that it might have been so unexpected that she would
vote. Right.
In both my races, I do think that my challenge was taken deadly seriously by the end, by Election Day, both mm-hmm. in 2016 and 2018. I have little doubt that Wasserman Schultz had the resources to have her consultants do plenty of polling. The fact that they didn't publish any polls says an awful lot. You could bet if she was up by 10 or 20 points, she would have published the polls. So they would have seen that we posed a real threat to beat her, and that would have provided plenty of incentive to prevent it from happening. Now,
yeah.
You said what can be done about it. I'm convinced the only solution that will restore any semblance of democracy and that would restore any faith and confidence that people have in the election system would be to get rid of these electronic voting machines
as they have throughout most of Western Europe and throughout Canada, and replace it with a system of 100% hand-marked paper ballots that are counted by hand in public on election night and reported immediately. And that's exactly the way it was throughout this country for 200 years.
But then if you've got a corrupt government, how do you get that passed?
That's the question, and I don't have an answer for that. I don't know if it requires yellow vests in the streets. I have no idea. But, you know, asking a Congress that got elected with this system to change the system when the machine doesn't want to be changed, yeah, good luck on that.
Right. Yeah, the only hope might be this younger generation. I mean, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is one, and then we saw it here in L.A. with the Public Bank L.A. group that were so dynamic in pushing for a public bank and got 44% of the vote with, like, no money and just with social media and things that, you know, just getting out and beating the bushes, rather like Alexandria did it. So they're just motivated. I mean, maybe arguably just got to wait for the old corrupt generation to die off. But I don't know. Or maybe I'm dreaming.
They're not going to reproduce themselves? I don't know. I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm not very at this moment.
Well, back to what the optimistic part or what, you know, possibilities here. So what did you come up with? What would you propose for reforming the Federal Reserve?
Well, the governance structure, of course, is completely anti-democratic. When you look at how the Federal Open Market Committee operates, you've got 7 members of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve sitting on that Open Market Committee, but those governors serve 14-year terms and can only be removed for good cause. So the governors themselves are there for 3.5 presidential administrations. We try to celebrate the independence of the Fed, but unfortunately the Fed is mostly a captured institution. It's captured by big Wall Street banks, because also sitting on that Open Market Committee are the presidents of the regional Federal Reserve banks. And those presidents are not selected by a president of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. Those regional Federal Reserve Bank presidents are chosen by private boards of directors. So, you know, there are a lot of folks who would like to end the Fed, as Ron Paul used to say. Whereas, you know, I think we need a central bank for now. It's convenient to have one. It could be useful to have one. So I think we need to mend the Fed, not end the Fed. And mending it means changing the governance structure so that it includes not just private bankers, but a representation of some of society's other interests, other constituencies. So debtor interests, consumers, workers, should really, I think it would be healthier if the central bank had a seat at the table for lots of differing perspectives and not just a narrow creditor's perspective. As far as what the Fed could actually do to address the economic crisis, which I think it really still is a crisis for most people, we were proposing that the Fed use its lending authority to, not just its lending authority, but even its open market operations in buying securities, to push money into state infrastructure banks, for instance, so the states could start putting people to work right away in rebuilding infrastructure. The Fed could buy up student debt. It could either have a debt forgiveness program, or it could modify the terms of that debt so that it's much, much lower interest rates. You know, in the 2 years following the financial collapse in 2009 and 2010, the Federal Reserve made something like $29 trillion in low interest loans. This is according to the Government Accountability Office that did an audit as part of the Dodd-Frank Act. And that $29 trillion in loans through the discount window were made to Wall Street banks and hedge funds and foreign banks and foreign central banks, usually at an interest rate of about 0.25%. So if the Fed can make those kinds of loans on that kind of a scale to big Wall Street interests, it could make loans at a much lower amount, not $29 trillion. I mean, if the Fed even loaned several hundred billion dollars or $1 trillion instead of to Wall Street banks, made it available to Main Street interests, it would do an awful lot for a bottom-up recovery. The Fed during the 1930s and 40s actually had a Section 13B, they called it, of the Federal Reserve Act, in which the Fed was authorized to lend, I think, up to $250 million, which at that time was a lot of money, but it was directly, loans directly to small businesses through the 12 regional Federal Reserve Banks. And they made over $120 million of loans under that program. So the Fed could do an awful lot. It could buy up mortgages and modify the terms of mortgages. These were all proposals that were, you could say, on the table by some of us who were on that advisory committee.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, so the Federal Reserve Act says that the Fed can only make, is it three-month loans or something like that, short-term six-month loans or something to municipal governments. I wonder why they put that in.
That's right.
It looks like they wanted to keep the states poor. Well, I'm just speculating, but why wasn't it in there originally that they could lend to state and local governments?
I think it was part of, you could say, the fiscal rectitude. That they wanted to make sure that the Fed was not making it easy for local governments and state governments to have an expansionary fiscal policy. So there is, you could say, a bias, an austerity bias that's sort of built into that. But, I've spoken to a couple of Fed governors in the past about that restriction, and the argument I made, I asked, why couldn't the Fed just buy up an awful lot of municipal bonds? They could be 90-day maturity. That's fine. But they let it be known quite publicly that they have every intention of rolling it over after 90 days and refinancing it and continuing to do it on a massive scale, not for, just for another, a second 90-day period, but they're going to do that on into the future for several years. That should probably, that kind of an open market operation in which they're buying short-term munis, but they're making it known that they will keep rolling it over. That should do an awful lot to bring down long-term yields on municipals as well. And
right.
I never really got a counter-argument from anyone on that. I mean, that seems quite clear that that would be the effect of that kind of a policy, and the Fed is still unwilling to do something like that. They're afraid, and this came out of conversations I had with Daniel Tarullo, a Fed governor who's pretty much known for his work on capital adequacy ratios. And when I put it to him directly to his face, you know, he basically conceded that the Fed won't do this because they're afraid of the reaction in Congress. So what does that tell you? That if the Fed spends trillions of dollars on Wall Street, there's no reaction in Congress. But if they spend even a small fraction of that for Main Street interest, there's going to be blowback. I wonder who controls Congress.
Right. And when they did do the $29 trillion, it was secret, right? I mean, we had to pry it out of them to get that information.
Exactly.
Probably Bloomberg, for the same reason they'd get blowback.
Yeah, well, that's true. That is true. And yet, you know, they weathered that storm, so to speak. The revelations that they had helped Wall Street on such a massive scale, they weathered that. So why wouldn't they be able to weather a program where they're actually helping real human beings get back to work to rebuild the economy? That was what Tarullo said, and, you know, I'm not sure I really buy it. I think a more likely explanation is just that the Federal Reserve is much more attuned to what Wall Street wants, and Wall Street doesn't want the Fed to be helping Main Street.
Right. Well, and there's that whole thing about if people have to borrow, including governments, then it's good for business, for banks. That's their business, is lending. So,
that's right. Wall Street would rather have government, state, local, and federal financing their operations on the bond market than getting free money from the Fed.
I know there's a Green New Deal proposal in the UK where the government would issue green bonds and then the central bank would buy them. So that would be rather like quantitative easing, but they would be, you know, it would be like targeted quantitative easing instead of just buying government bonds in general. You'd be buying something, you know, with a specific.
And the money from those bonds presumably would go into converting the economy to green and solar.
Yeah, whatever they decide that program is
right.
going to be all about.
Interesting.
I like the fact that the Green New Deal, first of all, it's quite vague about the did want to study it first, because it seems to me it's so controversial, even what's causing climate change. You do have to nail that down first. And they've included all sorts of social justice issues, which is great. The objection, of course, is how are you going to fund it? It's too broad of a program, but we know how to fund it. You could easily fund it.
Well, you know, I hear you and I agree, and it's great that Ocasio-Cortez is taking the lead on it, but it's never going to get through the House of Representatives until a lot more Democrats who think like Ocasio-Cortez get elected. And I don't think that's going to happen until Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders and a lot of others start understanding that that's not going to happen until we have paper ballots.
I have seen it argued, it's modern monetary theory says that the government does just borrow directly from the Fed. I mean, they just run an overdraft on their account, and that's how they spend. But I've seen other authorities sources say that that's not true, that the government can't write an overdraft on its account, that they have to have the money first. They can borrow, but they borrow it from themselves, like from other accounts that have a surplus, mm-hmm. funds or whatever, Social Security or something. I mean, I wanted to nail that down one way or another, and I couldn't find a definitive source.
No, I haven't studied the issue. I really haven't. You know, I
mean, obviously
I have,
they could. They could change the law.
Right. Yeah. No. Look, I listened to the MMT folks and reached the same conclusions. I think they go about it through a more abstract discussion, whereas I'm more likely to just point to our country's economic history as proof enough that the government has no real financial limits inherently on its fiscal policy, and mm-hmm. that the Federal Reserve certainly can monetize the debt and bring down the interest rates to near zero. There are a lot of ways that you could say to get the job done. You could have the Treasury issue United States notes directly into circulation as well. So that's a way to just expand fiscal policy without even incurring the debt. I know the MMT folks, the point they make is that the debt itself is needed. It's not inherently bad. I suppose with some caveats, if there's too much debt held by foreigners and the foreigners all start dumping Treasury or dollar-denominated assets, that could be certainly a bad turn of events. Although even if that were to happen, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, could still buy up those assets, and therefore there should not necessarily be a disruption. Have you followed much the way Donald Trump has been criticizing the Fed and the Fed chairman at various times, Jerome Powell?
Yes, and I've read people say, well, if he really wants to change their policies, that's not the way to do it, because you rather force them to push back the other way. But I've also read, you know, and I'd love a good conspiracy theory, that the goal here is to make it obvious that it's the Fed's fault. The Fed is messing up the economy. It's the Fed that's will cause the next recession, and many people say we're heading for another recession. If you raise interest rates now on where the whole world is drowning in debt, you're not going mm-hmm. to return to the old days where you got 5% on your account. You're just going to drive businesses out of business and cause a depression. So then mm-hmm. they can point to the Fed and say, the Fed did it. It wasn't me. I mean, the president can do that, you know. And maybe, arguably, we'll get some changes in the Fed if we have a big outrage over what they've done. I don't know. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Well, there might be a little truth in both theories. You know, I think that, first of all, I think Trump has somewhat succeeded in getting the Fed to back down. The Fed seemed, until pretty recently, committed to continuing to ratchet up interest rates a quarter point each open market committee meeting. And just in the past week or so, it seems like the reports are that the Fed has decided it's going to stop with those interest rate increases for now. So, I mean, Trump's pressure might have had an effect on the Fed. And I agree, it also lays the groundwork that if a recession does come, he and I imagine Republicans could point to the Fed's actions over the last year in raising rates. I know it was also overlaid with the discussion of whether Trump could fire Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman. And I think that was an interesting discussion that played out in some of the press and some of the financial press. It seems as if he would not really have good legal grounds to fire Powell as a governor with a 14-year term. To terminate a governor of the Fed, you'd have to have good cause and show some kind of misfeasance or malfeasance. But Trump would be on stronger grounds if he simply fired Powell as the chairman of the Board of Governors. In other words, saying, Jerome Powell, you can go back to being a governor, but you're not going to be a chair. And, you know, that it's an interesting, you know, kind of academic discussion. If it were to play out in real life and Trump were to do that, I don't know if it would be litigated in the courts. You could imagine that could go all the way to the Supreme Court. But I'm not sure what benefit he gets out of that kind of a confrontation anyway. The latest several rounds of interest rate increases by the Fed, I think the Open Market Committee was unanimous in raising rates. And they might have been unanimous to send a message to Trump, in fact, because earlier some of those interest rate increases did have divided votes.
That's interesting. Well, and then the market, of course, has been reacting poorly, and I think they always pay attention to that. It seems like they pay more attention to that than full employment.
That's
right. Allegedly, it's about full employment, but we're obviously not at full employment.
Clearly, I agree. I know on January 4th, there was a jobs report, which is a stunningly fantastic jobs report. Everyone's got jobs. You know, it's like, really? You're going to believe that? The Labor Department, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it just simply doesn't count tens of millions of people who are either discouraged workers or they're part-time workers who want full-time work and can't get it. So there wasn't a lot of
two jobs and they still can't pay the rent.
Exactly. And, you know, Trump and others who criticized those rate increases, I mean, they had good points to make in that the official unemployment rate is a fantasy. The inflation target, the Fed's not even reaching the inflation target where our inflation rate is lower than what they had targeted. You've got a yield curve that's very quickly approaching inversion, where the long-term yield is soon going to be as low as the short-term yield.
Yeah, you might have to explain that.
Sure. You know, usually if, let's say, we're talking about government bonds, bills, and notes, if the federal government is borrowing for 10 years compared to when it borrows for 90 days, the yield on the longer-term borrowing is normally a higher yield than short-term borrowing. You're going to have to pay somebody higher interest to borrow their money for 10 years than if you borrow their money for 90 days, because the future is usually more uncertain, I suppose, than looking at just 90 days. But if you're expecting future growth, all the more reason that the long-term yield will be higher than the short-term yield. When investors start having growing concerns about the economy, then you get what they call an inverted yield curve, where the yield on long-term borrowing drops dramatically, and the yield on short-term actually might go up. And, of course, the yield on short-term is kind of going up because of concerns about today's economy, that there could be a recession coming real soon. And the fears of a recession mean there's not going to be as much growth down the road. So I think right now the spread between long-term and short-term treasury yields is something like a quarter of a percentage point.
Wow. So that means that people don't want to borrow long-term. Is that what you mean? Because businesses don't want to borrow long-term because they can't see the future either?
Yeah, I think that is part of it. So as that yield curve is flattening, it's happening right when the stock market has had a tough patch for several months. So, you know, you add all that into the mix, and not surprisingly, a lot of folks are saying the Fed should not be raising interest rates right now.
Well, and this is Bob Hockett pointed this out, even if we were at full employment, I mean, even if we were really at full employment, there is a lot more that we can do. I mean, the fact that everybody has a job doesn't mean that that's all the output you can do. There are machines. I mean, there's the output of robots. There's outsourcing. Mm-hmm. You can send jobs abroad or whatever. I mean, you really can't tell if you're at full. The fact that you're at full employment doesn't mean that you're at full productive capacity. And you can't really tell that you are until mm-hmm. your demand outruns supply. When you can no longer fill orders because you've run out of materials or workers, then you really are at full productive capacity and not before that.
Well, that's true. When you look at World War II, what do you think the steel capacity utilization rate was during World War II? How high do you think it got?
I'm not sure what that means.
But when you look at the entire capacity of how much steel we could produce, like right now, industry is probably running at 60 to 70% capacity. So the steel mills were operating during World War II at 125% of capacity.
Wow.
So it was much higher than the government had even expected, had estimated the steel industry was capable of producing.
Wow, but so what does that mean? I mean, so 100% isn't really their total capacity. I mean, I could see where you could have people working overtime. You could say, well, everybody's got a job, so we're at full capacity.
Right.
But we're going to see everybody overtime.
Well, that's right. And when you talk about World War II, when you had factories that were operating three shifts a day, 24 hours a day, three eight-hour mm-hmm. shifts. So, you know, of course, the pre-war planners hadn't probably thought of capacity as including three shifts a day. They were probably thinking of the factories that were kept open for, I don't know how many hours, but not 24 a day.
Another hypothetical question. It's fairly obvious, we don't need to have that $21 trillion debt. We didn't need to have it in the first place. We could get rid of it by quantitative easing. If they could get rid of $2.7 trillion worth of debt, or was it $1.7 trillion? Anyway, what they bought in quantitative easing, $2.7 mm-hmm. then they could get rid of the whole thing just by moving it onto the books of the Fed. But mm-hmm. I have read that the problem is that if you don't have bonds out there, what are the pensioners? How are you going to support the pensioners and the savers? And, you know, that you need the bonds for the repo market and the derivatives market and all that sort mm-hmm. of thing, which just seems to me so upside down. The idea that you need a perfectly safe place to park your money and make money on it. Why do you even have the right to make money when you're not taking any risk? It's only the people that have money that get the benefit of that interest in the first place, which mm-hmm. is, you know, less than half the population. It seems like a conceptual problem to me that if we could change our vision of what, if the government gives people a safe place to park their money, that should be it. I mean, we might even have to pay the government. You pay the bank for your safety deposit box to store your stuff safely. Anyway, I just wonder if you have any thought on that.
It reminds me of the discussion of Keynes, the British economist. John Maynard Keynes, writing during the Great Depression. He talked about, I think it was in his essay, The Economic Possibilities of Our Grandchildren, in which he speculated about a future world where the rentier was the term they used in Britain at the time for the class of investors who basically make money just on interest. Mm-hmm. They live off of
the leisure class, as they said.
The leisure class, exactly. And he called it a future day when there'd be the euthanasia of the rentier, that mm-hmm. the government would drive interest rates down to near zero, and you wouldn't have any real reason for having interest. That right now, you could say money is scarce and labor is plentiful, but in an ideal world, labor would be more scarce. And capital would be quite plentiful. And as capital is more plentiful, the yield, the interest rate would be dropping to essentially near zero or even negative territory in real terms.
Yeah, I don't know how we'd change people's mindsets, but you could start by Social Security for all and Medicare for all, that sort of thing. I mean, if you had a basic safety net, it seems to me one problem with our capitalist system is that you're never secure. Even if you have millions of dollars, you probably have a multi-million dollar home with a big mortgage on it. So you're always in fear of losing what you've got and what could happen in the future. But if you had some sort of basic floor, an actual right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, something we probably really did have when we were frontiersmen and could go out and stake our plot of land, but now you have people that are born in the inner city that come into life with nothing. I mean, it seems to me it's the government's responsibility to provide a sort of floor so that you know that you'll always have a roof over your head.
And well, what gets me is when you articulate something like that, the response of a lot of people, especially people with wealth, is going to be that now you're sounding like a socialist. Now you're trying to spend other people's money. But when you think about it in terms that we already have a government that has a central bank, the Federal Reserve, that acts as the lender of last resort, essentially it's socialism for the wealth holders and very tough competition for everyone else. If the government can act as the lender of last resort to the point where it's throwing trillions of dollars at the financial institutions that created a panic and a collapse, if it's acting as lender of last resort, then certainly it can afford to be the employer of last resort.
Yeah, I remember somebody writing to me about his granddaughter, I guess it was. They were playing Monopoly. And the granddaughter had gotten all the chips, whatever it was, the money, and he was kind of bored with it. And he said, "Well, I'm out. I don't have any money." So she took her money and gave him half. And he said,
"Exactly.
Even a 5-year-old can see that if you want to keep the game going, you've got to share, spread the money around." I think that's what the Silicon Valley idea of universal basic income is. Like, oh dear, we're running out of customers. We've got to give them some money so they can buy our products.
Exactly.
Well, we've run beyond our time again, which is great. I love a good conversation. So do you have any other last thoughts you'd like to throw in?
You know, I guess 2019 will be a very interesting year to see what unfolds with the financial system and the economy. And, of course, if there's going to be some big developments in the markets, you could bet that it's going to have some big political implications, too. So it's certainly an exciting time to be alive and to be working on these issues.
Right. And you had mentioned you were going to do some writing, and I think you should do it not just academically, but get it out there where people can read it.
I'm happy to be no longer getting in the car and driving all over the district and campaigning. After 3 years of that, it's nice to be a professor again and to be writing. So I think we have a large audience, and we've got our work cut out for us.
Okay, that's great. Do you have a website?
Folks could go to timcanova.com and check out the campaign website. We also have a website at progressforall.org, and my academic work is available at SSRN, the Social Science Research Network.
Okay. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Ellen. My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Tim Canova, Professor of Law and Public Finance at Nova Southeastern University in Florida.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.